welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who wishes he were the 14th warrior in the 13th warrior. It's Adam Hodgins.
That has been my wish since 1999, that I could have been the 14th warrior.
I mean, so would you have just snuck on the boat?
Yeah, I think the way I get onto that that Norse boat is being is being weaker and feebler than the Arab guy.
Yep.
So I don't even register as not a threat, but even register as a person to those Norse guys. And so I'm just there by association. So, I'm kind of like, remember the old She-Ra show? And there would be that little guy they would put in the background of one scene, and they're like, that was the game, is during the episode you had to find him. It was like, where's Waldo during the episode of She-Ra?
Oh, wow.
And that's what I would be in the 14th Warrior. I'd be like, where'd you see me today, kids? I was on the boat in this scene.
Now, would you be angry if they're like, you know, there's 13 of us, and you're like, well, they know I'm here.
Yeah, you can't be, if you're on that boat, you can't be angry.
Yeah.
Because that movie is a wonder to behold. So to behold it from firsthand experience would even be better.
They're even jovial. They're very jovial on that boat.
They're literally washing their face in other men's snot, and they're happy about it.
Like, they never argue.
No.
This movie taught me that Vikings don't argue.
No, absolutely. Very, very much so. And I think Vikings get a bad rap. I don't think we celebrate Vikings enough. Like, aside from the DreamWorks Dragons franchise, do we really have a good Viking movie or like, of course we love the 13th Warrior, but other than that, is there like a good classic Viking tale?
Kirk Douglas in the 50s did Vikings. I used to like that one a lot. But they weren't really Vikings though. Dude, who's the guy, the $6 million man with the mustache?
Oh, Steve Austin,
yes.
But it was Lee Majors.
Lee Majors. He's in a movie called The Norsemen,
right.
Filmed in black and white. They wanted to film it in Canada, but he wanted to film it in Florida.
Makes sense.
So they're riding boats around with palm trees in the background. They're all incredibly shaved. Lee Majors has a mustache that is immaculate, which means people on his boat are shaving his mustache. It's called The Norsemen.
With giant Viking swords.
Yeah. I don't think people knew, like... Also,
but we don't have a shogun, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have Vikings. I love that show.
No, but that's, again, that's like 2016 that kind of came out. I'm talking I don't know. I think Vikings get a bad rap. I took a bunch of grade 8 kids on a field trip to the Ottawa Museum of Canadian History. And in that, in Canada, we're very proud of our Aboriginal people being the First Nations, we call them, because they're the first to settle here. But so we're going on this tour, and the tour guide says, and here, and there is one little display of a boat and a sword and a toque and a sweater. And she goes, this is, you know, because the Vikings were actually the first to settle in Canada for the whaling. But then they went home, and we don't really consider them to be the first to settle here.
Oh,
so like our country denies Vikings that right.
It's like there's Columbus Day, but it should be Viking Day.
Right. We should be really just wielding swords and like armored hats here in Canada, but we don't.
Wow. You just kind of, there's like an asterisk by them. Like they didn't stay.
Yeah. No, they were here, but then, you know, they went back to Viking land.
Well, you can't keep Vikings down.
No, but I did get her very angry at me because the rest of the tour, I kept asking questions about Vikings. Like, who'd win in a fight, a First Nations warrior or a Viking servant? And things like that didn't go over well.
You shook her to her core, didn't you?
I did. I really kind of...
Because on those tours, you have your spiel. And sometimes when you get your spiel interrupted, it's hard to get back to it.
You don't know where to go. It's over, man. It's... Yeah.
That's why I never have spiels. I just kind of let it flow. I let it go.
You got to know what you're saying. And I'm not just read the script.
I'm much like the Vikings. I just kind of get in a boat and attack whatever coastal village is close to me.
Right. But speaking of not going over well, this movie in 1999, huge flop.
They just dumped it in the theaters.
No promo, no nothing.
Nothing.
And so I think I might have mentioned this before, but my mom and I often go to the movies together, still to this day. We're very excited about Creed 2. That's going to be our one this year.
Oh, my gosh.
But this was the one that we went in 1999. This is one of the ones we went and saw together.
I went with my mom as well.
Oh, see, look at this.
And we were, you know, I'm 36, so I went with her when I was 17. I wasn't that cool teenager. I was like, I'm going to go with my mom, the 13th Warrior.
I'm 37. I was in exactly the same situation. But again, Zorro had just came out. So Bandera and Desperado was one of my favorite movies.
Oh man, that was 94. Yeah.
And so Antonio Banderas was like, I was okay by him. And movies like Robin Hood and like these kind of historical legendary kind of movies were really in my wheelhouse. And so this has really ticked all my boxes. Like I love this movie, but again, it's tough. More so in 2018 when you love a movie than read the internet and you're like, well, maybe I was wrong. Like maybe I don't love that movie. But no, I thought this was great when I saw it, but nobody loved it.
I read an Ebert review by Ebert today, and he was hating on it. And I think this movie just had – this is – I mean, I can't speak for everyone. And there are some uneven moments in this, and you can feel some of the reshoots in the film with the added little relationship thing. And then they kill that – there's like a weird side plot about some prints that they just drop. They didn't need that.
Yes.
But that was added. That was added later on. And you know what's funny? I remember I was talking to my brother. He went and watched it because he was at college at the time. He's like, why'd they kill that big guy? He'd have been helpful. And I was like, that makes sense. Like, why did that? But yeah, Ebert didn't like. I think they were just establishing
how badass that guy was, though. Like, he toyed with him.
Yeah, that dude was huge. Oh, no, the little guy was awesome. Yeah, he was a badass.
Yeah. No, he was like, he was their secret weapon. And I think it was like, you guys are Vikings, but we are the 13 warriors. Like, don't confuse those two things here for just a second.
Listen, we get that you're tough. You're good with a sword, but we're, like you said, we're the 13 warriors.
Yeah, no, we are. We're the big deal.
And maybe we'll consider the 14th warrior, but probably not.
We might get there.
Yeah, that's right. So, but
he's on the boat.
You know what I think about this movie is it seemed to have a lot of bad buzz. A lot of the reviews that I was reading from 99, they're like, this was filmed 2 years ago and it sat on the shelf with reshoots and they just dumped it in the theaters. That's what, not like that. I don't know whose voice that was, but they...
No, I love this review character you have. I think we should just explore this more.
You know, I don't even want to consider this movie because they just dumped it in theaters and it's been delayed. Like, I think that was what people did. I think they went into it with a negative vibe. And I think that happened with John Carpenter and a few other movies that were delayed or had budget problems. Whenever there's a movie that has a lot of budget, Lone Ranger. So John Carter's a serviceable movie. It's fun. But Lone Ranger had a ton of bad buzz about it. People hated it. But it's a visually inventive and weird and fun movie.
I like Lone Ranger. John Carter's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, see, and you know how much bad buzz it has?
I love that movie.
I wrote an article about it, like, just about how, and this is years and years ago, about how just the press kind of buried it before it came out. And you know what's funny? I worked that following pilot, and my role was to run in on handcuffed James Purefoy and take him out of a room.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see the following pilot, just go to the end. You'll see me in it. And during the scenes, I was talking to Purefoy. I'm like, hey, man, like, what happened to Carter? I love that movie. He's like, everyone loved it. He's like, we all thought great things. I was going to have a big role in the sequel. And then he's just like, bad buzz. People didn't like it. This negativity.
Yeah, and I think, too, I think one of the producers wanted to – because lots of those guys like Favreau and all – like even Defoe who was in there, they all like loved the Princess of Mars books, right? Like they were all huge John Carter fans. And so they were all very cool with the idea of keeping everything secret. Like, don't let the people see what the Tharks look like. Don't let. And so there was no toys. There was no posters. There's no Disney machine behind it.
Yeah.
And so, and then again, the Disney formula of nobody wants to go to Mars and no one cares about princesses that are boys. So that calling it a Princess of Mars, they scrapped that title and called it John Carter, which, what does that mean? Is it a lawyer? Is it a stand-up comedian?
Sounds like a sequel to The Firm.
Yeah, exactly. So, but again, I think if Disney's not behind something, no matter how good the movie is, they need that Disney machine. And I think this is what happened in 13th Warrior. There was no hype for it whatsoever.
Yeah, and I really think that it was just bad buzz. But what I love most about this movie is, so I was reading a lot of this behind. There's not much behind the scenes talk of this film. So I did as much digging as I could. And you know, we found out director John McTiernan, who also did Die Hard and Predator, he took a plane out by himself. You probably read this and flew around. They were going to go to Norway, but he's like, they cut all the trees down. It looks barren. It looks soft. He's like, but I was flying around British Columbia and there was just an area I found surrounded by trees for 5 miles and they filmed there. Yeah. This movie, you know, The Revenant got a ton of bad buzz for shooting in the wilderness and I mean, it was an absolute insane shoot from all accounts. But
and this is an exhausting movie to watch because of that.
And this movie, though, just it holds up. This movie's going to hold up in 20 years because the sets are built practically. There's a lot of in-camera shots. There is some visual effects. But for the most part, they built big sets. They put 40 people on horseback, put bear outfits on them, and have them charge with flames in their hands towards the camera.
That's why it does. And that's why Conan the Barbarian is one of my favorite movies, because it's always going to look like Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
Like, it's no soundstage. They built this city and they built and there's something to be said about that in camera. You're watching. It's almost like you went back in time and just filmed the Norsemen doing their thing, and that there's nothing artificial about it.
Mm-mm. And also, I like that Banderas, much like Kurt Russell in Big Trouble in Little China, Banderas wasn't the tough guy in the beginning of this movie. He just got off of two Desperado and Zorro, massive buzz, and he played the little guy who becomes the tough guy. But in the beginning, they make fun of him. So I love how he went into this without an ego. And yeah, I mean, did this. Like, this is, I don't know. I love it. I love this movie.
I also think that I don't even consider Banderas the hero of this movie. I think he's the narrator of this movie. Yeah. And he's actually telling the story of the 13 warriors and of Beowulf.
Yeah. And
I think we see it through his eyes, because I can relate to Banderas. I've been the small guy before. I've never been the alpha, like, you know, the big Norseman is. So I don't think this is his story. I think he's just telling the story of this adventure.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think. And so Beowulf, right, is the hero of this movie. And you know,
he's the guy.
Everybody, not everybody, but when you talk to a majority of the mostly men who are our age, when you talk to them about Beowulf, everyone loves him.
Everyone does.
Dudes our age love Beowulf because he's just he's all business. He kills the, well, I guess we'll get in the movie on, but just the stand that he makes, the way he leads, like just the whole dude's demeanor. So you talk to him. Yeah.
Also the way he commands a room. Like, there's 12 alpha males there. Nobody questions his word.
Yeah. I mean, if one of us were the leaders, there'd be infighting everywhere. People would be scheming to get the top.
We'd still be discussing whether to bring the Arab with us or not.
Yeah. So Beowulf just takes care of business. And, oh, man. But this movie, though, they said that the budget ballooned up to about $180 million inflated for today's money.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know what, though? I think that's a reason why it still is building and has a cult audience, because it looks great.
And again, it's way more expensive to be on set shooting than on a sound screen or like in a sound stage with green screen. And so the reason it costs so much money is also the reason it looks so good.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. No, it's brilliant to watch. One of my favorite things at the beginning of the movie is, and this is coming from a pastor, but that their religions are compatible. So you have like the Arab like advisor. So Banderas is exiled from his kingdom because he seduced the king's wife, right?
Yeah.
So then he gets sent out with like his buddy there, his advisor,
Omar Sharif,
who then's like, oh, you're gonna get called in this adventure, and then the Bone Lady comes in and casts down like the bone lots, and so we get the Arab religion, and then we get like this Norse like witchcraft, and somehow they're both like pointing in the same direction and very compatible religions.
Yeah.
Which always I was like, that's an interesting twist that isn't explored more often. Like, where are their roots? Do they actually combine back to the same deity? We don't know that, but we do know all signs are pointing that you will be the 13th guy.
Yeah. And he was not happy about that.
No, he wanted to write poetry and pray. That's what he wanted to do.
I do love, though. So in the beginning of the film, he gets sent away, and there's these, you know, raiders, whatever, going to attack his party, and some Vikings just randomly roll up on a river, and then the marauders run away. They're like, run away,
Monty Python. We know better.
Yeah, exactly. We're not messing with Beowulf. And what I like, though, is the people in Antonio Banderas's party, or Eben, I guess we can call him Eben.
Eben. That's yep.
They're like, we shouldn't talk to them. And he's like, I'm an ambassador. I'm supposed to talk. And I like that scene with him. And when he listens later on, and when he learns their language, I feel like with him, he's a very curious soul. And so when he says, I'm supposed to talk, I thought that was a really good line that establishes him as a character.
Well, I think right away we're given maybe his worst character trait, right? That he seduced, he stole somebody's wife. So yeah. But everything he does after that, even though it's not the easy decision, it's always the right decision.
Oh,
so
wow,
it wasn't
yeah.
easy to go talk to the Vikings, but he did it. It wasn't easy to go on the adventure or the quest with them, but he did it. You know, it wasn't easy for him to figure out a way to keep up with those big guys, but he did it. And so everything along, and even at the end when he leaves, it's, you know, it might have been easier for him to stay there and just, you know, be assimilated into the culture, you know, dances with wolves style. But he always does the right thing. So I think we're really getting that he is the moral compass of this movie.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think of it. Man, you really broke that down.
Oh, I love this movie.
And I do want to say, though, when he first walks into the Vikings, they're having a funeral. But I hate, in movies, medieval parties or Viking parties. So you have Lord of the Rings, you have all these. Whenever you walk into a bar, there's always people laughing really loud, slamming stuff down, eating a big thing of meat, and everyone's patting each other on the back like they just said the greatest joke ever.
I wanna say this to you, too. It's medieval parties, Viking parties, and Klingon parties.
Oh, really? Klingons just roll like that, too?
Klingons, it's just a Viking party, man.
Everyone is laughing. Am I that cynical? It's weird. No. There's like, I just hate, like, and remember in Lord of the Rings when he's kind of seeing things or he's kind of being weird, Frodo, and all those people in the I don't know, the place where Stryker,
the prancing pony,
Aragorn, yeah, they're all just laughing, and I just can't stand it. I hate it.
No, and this may be, I don't know if this will be a popular statement or not. I can't stand those Lord of the Rings movies.
Really?
Oh, they're so long.
Oh, I love them. Every other year I probably watch all of them. With The Hobbit and the other ones, director's cuts.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm standing in awe of you. I've tried. So both Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, I've tried to get into those series. I just keep falling asleep.
Oh, man, I love them.
I can't do it.
When I was working in a theater when I was 19. Let's see. No. That was 2001. So, yeah, I was 19. And I would close the theater. So
yeah,
I don't know why, but they always had Lord of the Rings starting at the same time as the last movie. That was about an hour and 45 minutes. So I'd get the entire theater cleared out, lock the doors. And then I just go watch the ending of Fellowship of the Ring for the last hour for probably 30 times because that movie was in the theater forever. So I just love that movie. And I love Sean Bean in that movie. I love the human element. I just think as filmmaking, it was amazing.
I do love Sean Bean, and we're going to get into a deep cut Sean Bean movie a little later on in the podcast.
Oh, really? Oh, I love it. Oh, a deep Sean. Okay, good. I'm looking forward to this. All right, so they sit down, and you know what I like? There's this boat that comes up with some people from, I don't know where, Viking land, and they sit in the mist to make sure that people see them so they're not a creature. I thought that was a pretty interesting idea.
There was some really cool subtleties, and I think that speaks to the Michael Crichton writing of this whole thing. Right, is that there's these he definitely did his research, because this was a thing where he was at a lecture, right, and then someone said Beowulf was a boring story that no one would care about anymore. So he took that as a challenge to, like, I'm gonna write an interesting Beowulf Viking story and you're gonna love it. And so he wrote
Eaters of the Dead,
and so he wrote that in response to that. So I think these are some of the intricacies that he would look up, and, you know, whereas I think John McTiernan, it would be, where's the next action beat? Where's the next action beat? So I think some of that flow we get that is maybe pacing a little bit differently than a normal action movie is the Michael Crichton influence. And I think that's why audience didn't digest it as well as a regular John McTiernan movie.
Did you watch the interview with Vlad Kulik, behind the scenes interview? So he said some pretty – what? Do you want me to get into it?
The whole time – No, you do it, but I was going to say, the whole time I was watching that, I was like, someone please cast this guy in a Dolph Lundgren biopic.
Yeah, he stays felt, man.
Yes,
but
he does.
I thought it was interesting how he said McTiernan told a very, what show not tell, but Crichton wrote a tell, like just write a writer movie. And I wish, I really, as much as I love the finished product, but I think McTiernan's, maybe it was just too grim, maybe too silent, too war heavy. And I think I want to see that movie.
No, there's definitely like the part of you that wants to see, when you love something, you want more of it.
Oh,
so
for
whether
sure.
it's it's a good cut or a bad cut. I want to see that cut of it. So one of my all-time favorite movies, hands down, is Billy Jack. Are you aware of Billy Jack?
Uh-uh. What's Billy Jack?
So Billy Jack is the most successful independent film of all time. It was the first white guy to ever use karate in a movie. And it was like this very hippie-centered, I think it came out in 71. And it was about like this half Native American, half white Vietnam War vet whose girlfriend ran a special school for pacifists. It was crazy. And you have to watch it. It's fantastic. You would love it. But to make that movie, mm-hmm. he first made a movie called Born Losers to finance Billy Jack. And then he made Billy Jack Goes – The Return of Billy Jack. And then he made Billy Jack Goes to Washington. And so the three other ones aren't great. However, after that, he made The Return of Billy Jack – or Billy Jack Strikes Again. And he made half that movie and the funding got cut. So there's a half Billy Jack movie out there somewhere that I haven't seen. And oh my goodness, what I wouldn't give to see it.
Oh my – and you know, they were working on a movie called Ernest – they built a ship. Ernest is a pirate or something.
Oh,
pirate
my
Ernest.
Goodness.
And they were filming it, and he, you know, tragically, he passed away. But they had a ship built and everything. They were filming an Ernest movie about him being a pirate.
Right? Isn't that incredible? Don't you just need to see that?
Yeah, give me 13 minutes of it.
Right? Or even the George Miller Justice League movie that, like, just give me the costume tests. Give me that.
Oh man, give me the script read through. Give me the script. That movie would have been fantastic.
Oh, it would have been amazing. Because George Miller doesn't do anything bad. Babe is fantastic, even though it's about a pig.
I mean, well, that was a Best Picture nominee.
Right?
He made a – yeah,
no, George
pig.
Miller's the man.
Yeah, he's a beast. He would have done a good one of these. But I still like what McTiernan did.
Yeah.
But – all right. So actually, we have a couple questions that we didn't get to. And one of the questions is – well, it's more of a statement. So – our friend Nathan said he wrote a paper in college about the outfits, the costumes in 13th Warrior, and he said none of them fit the time frame or the location, and he wants to know why.
Well, I think
I did some research and I found out.
Okay, you go. I was going to give my hypothesis, but you want me to give my idea, then we'll see how close it is?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's hear it.
Okay, so when I was in the Canadian Museum and they said Vikings were the first people and they had their display and their clothes there, they were very boring clothes. So I think that the period correct Viking clothing was way too boring and not warrior enough. So they took artistic license to make them look more like warriors.
They said that in a certain amount of words. They just said, okay. We did not go period appropriate. We just did what we felt was right for the film. But they also added this in here. And they said that the disparate armor worn by the Vikings can be explained by the Norse tradition of taking the armor of a vanquished foe. It was also a display of status in Norse society. The nicer the armor, the higher position. Hence, a bovice ornate set, and why Halga appears to have a helmet of a Roman gladiator, which he does. So they took those from people. So that's why they don't match up. So like you said, they took artistic license because the outfits were probably pretty boring and they didn't look cool.
Right.
But also Vikings took from, you know, they stole. Like, they pillaged everything.
Yeah, they were just scavengers.
Yeah, and so they had more ornate with higher things, or they took from that. That's why the guy had if you see in the movie, he does have a Roman gladiator helmet, and he probably took that in a battle. So that's why. So they took artistic license, and they also planned on them just having a different look because that's what Vikings did. So that's pretty cool that that's explained.
Yep. I'm behind that 100%.
All right. And
what's the second question?
The next question is, how long did it take for Eben to learn their language?
Okay. So
can we build up the scene? So they're traveling on their way to the boat, correct?
Yeah.
And they probably
not like Eben. They hate this guy so far.
They hate Eben, and I think they probably traveled, got on the boat. They probably got out in the water, did some more trips, parked somewhere, did this, that, and the other. So you think it was done in maybe one night?
Well, I'm looking at Eben, and he is a scholar. He's a poet. Like, he studies language. So I think this is really in his wheelhouse. And from what you can tell about language is once you establish the root language, the rest of it is just semantic. Okay, that's the key. So I think Eben very quickly, within a day or two, was able to decipher this language.
Oh, wow. I mean, that could be because that scene doesn't really show him moving much. But I guess I got the vibe that they were traveling for a long time. This wasn't like Pirates 3, where in 1 second they're in, you know, 1 second they're in China, the next second they're in the Caribbean, and then the next second they're back in China, and then they're back, you know, then they're in Australia, then they're there. This movie, I felt they traveled for a while. They would take their boat out, and he just listened, and he just observed during this long journey. Because let's face it, like, these boats, they move fast, and they're well-equipped, but it would take a while. So I just think over the course of all these different times, he just sat and listened. So they probably thought he was being morose, and they didn't even worry about him. And they're like, he doesn't understand us. So they didn't.
Yeah, he's a simpleton.
Yeah, so he, I think over that time, he figured it out. And I think what you're saying could happen as well. But for me, I just got that vibe where it had taken a while. And I actually appreciated it because it seems like it would be a pretty long journey to get to where they went.
Right. But I think we can both agree that it is one of three of the most BA scenes in this movie, of all movies. Like,
I love it.
It's brilliant.
I listened. And why do people, like, do you think that's just, you know, when people make fun of scenes because they just make fun of it, do you think this got made fun of because people just think it's a scene that gets made fun of? I liked it a lot.
No. And I think this, so when I watch this with my mom, and then the next day I was like, oh, and so some of my friends went to go see it, like, with just their friends. I said, like, did you guys love it? Like, it's really good. And again, they were already making fun of that. Oh, I listened. Oh, I listened. And, like, the way that was shot, the way that was revealed, he had that moment where he just, like, put them in their place. I thought it was just, like, it showed again he's doing the right thing. He's caring. He's listening. But he's also, like, not to be messed with. That's the first hint of, like, oh, there's something with this guy you got to watch out for. He's more than meets the eye. He's a transformer.
And, oh, that'd be, how on him, he's Bumblebee. So they, but I also like as a narrative choice, remember in that movie Valkyrie when it starts, right? He's writing in German and then it slowly transitions to English.
Hunt for Red October does the same thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. So, like, that's a good choice. It kind of lets the audience know, we know, but this is what we're going to do. And this movie, I think, it, you know, you started off with the languages. They didn't understand each other. And then not only do you get to switch over to just primarily English, but you also establish the character that he is observant and he does want to communicate and he does want to keep learning. So it's a twofer. It's good for the narrative and then it's good for the character.
Exactly.
Now,
and go ahead.
Oh, no, go.
I was just saying, the way that it was, they did the whispers and the overlay of the English and the Norse language. It was almost musical the way they did that. It was so good.
Yeah, and sometimes there were times where they, if he quite didn't understand the word, they still used, like, they threw in a random term. So there were, even when they were speaking some English, there were random phrases that weren't quite in English. So maybe he didn't understand that or he
wasn't fluent, but he got by.
Yeah, I think that's really, I don't know. I just love that idea. And it was just a smart narrative discussion. So, you know, this movie, I get that the clothes aren't good, but they made that decision and then they made the decision with the I listened. And I, you know, I have a question. If it wasn't so maligned, would you still like the I listened part as much? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know. I just, again, I think it's such a good character moment.
Yeah.
It's such a win for Eben.
And
you can't take that from him in any way you look at it.
That's like what I think it is, one of my favorite characters. You know what, this is really random. And there's probably others, but if I think about it, but one of my favorite character moments ever is in The Bourne Legacy with Jeremy Renner. And they introduced Edward Norton's character by just having him running in the rain at 4 a.m. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't talk. Well, obviously, if he doesn't say anything, he doesn't talk. There's no name tag on him. But he's just running in the rain at 4 a.m. Like, what does that tell you about a character that he can run in the rain at 4 a.m.?
Tells you that one day he yearns to be Tom Cruise.
Yeah, but that the dude's driven. He probably has a solid routine.
Yeah, I was going to say he's very regimented.
Yeah, and so just watching a guy run in the rain at 4 a.m. tells you everything you need to know about him. And so I know he says I listened, but that also really builds the character well as far as Banderas goes.
Yep,
I like listening to Vikings talk, though. I wish it would have been all in, Norwegian or what's the Norwegian?
Yeah, Norwegian.
Or just do the Viking weird accent in the show Vikings.
Exactly.
Or Floki.
So I looked up some Norwegian Viking stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how everybody has weird delicacies that they eat? Like, each culture has weird delicacies?
Yeah.
In Norway and in Iceland, one of the delicacies is they take a shark. So they catch a shark and then they take the guts out and they bury it on the beach and let it rot for 6 months. And then they dig it up and eat it.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, I respect that. They're not just like those shark finners. Like
they eat the whole thing.
Like, and see, I'd do it. Would you do it?
I would try it.
I'd let you do it first. I'd let the 14th warrior eat it.
Right, that's because no one's going to see me eat it. If I die...
You always keep a 14th warrior.
To eat the fermented shark carcass. Yeah,
just in case.
But I'm just saying, like, if you were to say, hey, we're making a fictional movie about warriors, what's the, like, most warrior-like food? It's like, well, they take a monster from the sea and let it rot, and then they eat it. Like, that's the thing that's real. And it's called Hakarl.
Do they still do it?
No, you can go there now and buy some.
Do they sell it at IKEA? Even though it's Swedish?
I don't think so. I don't think the Swedes can handle fermented shark meat.
I did write a fake movie called Sharks in Sweden starring Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, why is that a fake movie? Why can't that just be a movie that's not been made yet?
And I also wrote a fake story about a movie called Squid Lake, about some squids that get into the Great Lakes and they just adapt and then they terrorize the Great Lakes.
Did you see that? This is a way bunny trail, but did you see that video that came up last week of the guy kayaking in Australia?
No. What
happened? And then there's these seals around there and they don't like them, so they're like splashing them and stuff. And this seal swims into the ocean and then jumps out and throws an octopus at a guy's face.
Oh, I did see that.
And I'm just like, how crazy is that in a world we live in where a seal doesn't like you so much he throws an octopus at your face?
I mean, couldn't the seal just dive at him?
I think a seal is more threatening than an octopus, but it's just so insulting.
Yeah, and especially if the octopus latches onto you.
Yeah, I think it stuck to his boat for a minute or two.
Very confused octopus.
Yeah, no. But anyways, Vikings are crazy, and they eat sharks.
Then they buried in the beach?
They buried in the beach.
Now, I want to tell you something really cool. I found a quote from Peter Menzies Jr. You probably read this. He was a director of photography on this film. And he wrote, "This is an epic film, and we wanted to get that scope on a wider screen, so we shot it with an anamorphic ratio, which I think really helps with the main attack in the middle portion of the film." Says Menzies, referring to the wider lens format used to photograph a horizontally extended image. So, you know, Spielberg shrunk it down to 1.85 to make the T-Rex look bigger. They use widescreen to make everything just look grander, I guess. Yeah. And so we did mount the camera onto modern vehicles and steadicams, and we use planes as well for some photography. Yet the audience still needs to be involved in the action and to move with the story. So we did a great deal of handheld work, which gave it that very involving third-person sort of feel. And you can get that in that movie. And I think one of the best – I'm telling you, I've already mentioned it, but one of my favorite shots of the last, I don't know, 25 years is watching the Wendels?
Yep.
Yeah, watching them charge in a row on their horses into that kind of fort. I mean, that's –
like much, much better than the charge of Braveheart.
Yeah, for sure. But if you think about it, they put 40 people on horses at night with fire, and they just shot them rampaging through. That's a practical, expensive,
and awesome in costumes that definitely hindered their vision.
Yeah, I mean this shooting that shot, it looks awesome, but that was tons of mud, huge undertaking to get them all reset, but.
Oh, that's the thing. Doing it once isn't the magic trick. The magic trick is doing it five times and editing it together.
Yeah. And also, you're right. That's a lot. And so, and then I guess we'll talk to a shot in a little bit. So they get to the place. They find out that this king there is under attack. His house is terribly undefended. There's no one there. Let's see what happens.
And then that's when they say it's the fireworm, right?
Yeah, the fireworm. And then they're like, yeah, there's no dragon. And, you know, I guess the creatures kind of find out that they're there. You think that they're just bear creatures, something like that. And, no. Sorry, guys. So they go out looking at this house. They see that these people have been eaten, correct? All the 13th warriors. But then what I love the most is when they're leaving, one of the scouts is like, look to the right, look to the left, look behind. No, he doesn't say look, but behind us, by the ridgeline, by the rocks. He knows every single thing that's looking at him right then and there. And then Banderas goes to look at him, and he's like, don't look at him. Come on, man. Like, what are you, a rookie? But I just love that scene because It shows that they're everywhere, but it also shows that the guy's knows, and he's known for some time, and that just makes them the baddest dudes, and I love that moment.
So when you were explaining that scene to me, which I've seen a number of times, and I agree with you, it's a moment. So imagine these guys, these warriors who survived this movie, their next adventure is a predator comes down because of their superior fighting skills. He wants them as his trophy.
They'd kill the predator. The predator's a wimp.
I know, but McTiernan directing that movie?
Oh my gosh. Would the predator use a stupid heat-sinking cannon on him?
I think he would try, but these guys would somehow know, and they cover themselves in mud because they're all covered in mud anyways.
Don't you think that's cheating, though? So you can become invisible, and you have a laser cannon on your shoulder.
Yeah, no, predators are pretty cheap fighters.
You know what's funny? That's what really kept me from really loving Predator. Because I was like, this guy's cheating. I think I was like 12. Right? And I was like, this guy's dumb. And I felt bad for all the guys getting killed. I'm like, why don't you, like, I was hoping that we could see the scene where he fights Billy on the tree. But he probably cheated there too.
Yeah, no, he's definitely, they have overhyped the Predator's skills because he just has lots of toys. Like, remember in AVP? I can't believe we're talking about that movie. But where they didn't have their guns and they were getting their butts whooped.
Yeah, they were getting handled.
Right?
Wimps. So
by baby aliens.
So what I love here is they know they're watching. And so that means that the creatures, the Wendels are going to come attack and see what they're all about. So they go to the king's house. And the 13 warriors sleep in a circle, sleep in quotation marks, but they're fake sleeping. And I love that scene. I'm like, why are they sleeping? Then when I saw it in 99 that they were pretend snoring, I was like, this is amazing. But I love how they film the first battle with a lot of very silhouette shots. They're kind of in the shadows.
They don't give away the reveal yet.
Yeah, and it's primal. There's a scene where one of the bear creatures or whatever you think they are, the Wendels, are coming at Banderas, and the way that they fight, like the way that they swing the swords, it looked real to me. So I just love, and then there's the silhouettes. I love the shadows that they use. You still kept them a mystery, and that was just a very smart way to not only establish that the Vikings are tough dudes, but then these things are not to be messed with, and they take heads and they take other bodies. And I also like that at the end of the battle, the Vikings were huffing and puffing.
They were tired. They were brought to their limit. This scene makes me feel the same way that playing paintball when you're like getting fired at and you don't know where the bullets are coming from. It's that same visceral feeling.
Yeah. I've played paintball a couple times and I just get shellacked.
No, it's as a youth pastor, I play paintball way more than any person should who's not a professional paintball player. And it's unnerving.
But this opening battle scene, they have this shot of they're just following a decapitated head out a door. Like, it's a very quick, smart battle scene to establish that. And so, I don't know. I thought that was a very smart decision to make before the really big battle.
I wonder if the perfect version of this movie is a combination, knowing ahead of time, that Michael Crichton's going to direct all the, like, dramatic and conversational scenes, and McTiernan will direct just the action scenes.
See, I just want to just let McTiernan do it. Let McTiernan do it. Because when has that ever worked well when you have these two people kind of doing that? I mean, I know there are co-directors, like the Coen brothers and stuff.
Russos, but that's a team going in, not a team that's forced to do it.
Yeah, I just think that would have been too different. I mean, McTiernan had the chops to make this movie. I just think this is at the apex of Crichton's power. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, Crichton's not a filmmaker. And I think he knows what audiences want. Well, no, he directed Westworld, didn't he?
Yeah, when you say at the height of his power, this is after Congo, right?
Yeah, but Congo was a big hit. That made money.
Oh, how did that make money and this one didn't? How?
I don't know. Yeah, that was an event. So I lived in a small town. And when we first got our big theater, like, we didn't have a nice theater. We just had, like, the little ones. And when our first big theater got built up, on the opening day, I went and watched Congo. Wow. And I was like, this is not good. But the theater was
I watched that a couple months ago, and I forgot Bruce Campbell was in it.
Yeah. That was a big deal, because I remembered that. I'm like, Bruce Campbell's in it? I got to see this.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was his big break. But
that was his biggest role.
So I mean, I guess he had Jurassic Park, he had Congo. I think he had some power there. I just don't know why. It just seemed like there was a lot of. It seems like almost a Rogue One situation, but Rogue One was successful. Where Rogue One, apparently the director's cut's very warlike and very downer. And then they came back and refilmed it with Tony Gilroy came to direct the scenes, and they added all the hope into it.
Right.
I want it like a nihilistic 13th Warrior. Because after this initial attack, you know, they build the fort and that's all cool. Everything looks beautiful. But this is the middle part between the first attack and then the big battle. And I guess 2/3 of the way in is where it really slows down, because you add this random relationship. You know, Banderas is talking to some blonde Viking lady. And then you got to have that, though. What?
You got to have a lady.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. But the problem is, if her character was actually written well. But I just feel like they threw her in. I feel like that was
that was definitely a studio decision.
Yeah, and so for me, they're just like, we need somebody else in here. And I don't think that did this. Yes, she did fine as an actress. She did exactly what she needed to do,
as good as any actress could have done.
Yeah, but it was an afterthought of a character. And it came after this high of this really cool battle and this journey and all this. And then you have the scene where there's this prince and he's planning something. So then this guy goes and throws mud on some dude's back, and then he cuts his head off. And it establishes him as a tough guy, but it also kind of makes them look jerky because they just decapitated a really good fighter.
But here's the question. Was he a good fighter if he got decapitated?
I mean, would you want to have him on your side during a battle?
Yeah, I would. But that's also the point in time where Eben grinds his sword down.
Oh, yeah. I love that scene. You give him a sword, he makes a knife.
Yeah, I think that's like the quintessentially agreed upon. Oh, that was the one good scene in that movie.
Yeah, and then he comes and he just smashes the he starts making the stakes really good, and they still make fun of him.
Yeah, he starts doing like ninja moves and stuff.
I wonder if Knight's Tale kind of copied this a little bit, because they make fun of the horse, and the horse jumps over a guy. And then everyone laughs, and they're like, this horse is great. And then they make fun of his sword. Then he does a great job with the sword. Remember Knight's Tale, where all the knights are laughing at him with the little armor? Then he just jumps right on the horse.
I firmly believe that you and I could do a commentary track to A Knight's Tale and reveal that there is not one single original idea in that movie.
But I love that movie.
Oh, no. Together, it's a great combination. But I feel like it's this spoof movie that no one knows is a spoof movie.
I mean, there's a lot of weird humor in it.
Yeah, but I think every joke and every bit is taken from something else.
And I don't like the extras in that movie at all.
Oh, I don't. There's a lot about that movie that you love the movie on a visceral level, but you know it's wrong.
Medieval peasants. I hate medieval extra peasants.
As fun as the soundtrack is.
Oh yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
They got Bowie.
You want to talk about costumes that are not period correct? Everything that princess wears. How is that lady the princess? Like, it doesn't even make any sense.
But that's why I like it. It's like a weird modern take, even though it happens in the past. It's a hybrid movie.
No, and someone explained to me one time, he's like, that's why it's not a knight's story, it's a knight's tale.
Oh.
Right?
Man, that's like, I would give him a high five for saying that.
It was a good moment.
What was that person really pleased with themselves? Did they do a victory lap?
Sean did not do a victory lap, but I think he was pleased. He went home and he's just had a smile on his face when he went to bed that night.
All right, so let's get into the big battle. So they fortify the entire place. Antonio Banderas goes out to give some guy a food at the watchtower, but the guy's not there. He sees the guy in the tree, and Banderas is like, I look for you in the tower. And the guy's like, yeah, that's why I'm not there. That's another cool line. He's my favorite of all of them, except for Bullvife, the dude who can just see everything.
But again, you see Banderas is doing the right thing, these honorable things, but he sees that these less educated men are definitely smarter than he is.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. I mean, I love that line. You weren't in the watchtower. Yeah, I know, because that's where everyone's looking for me at. Like, what a cool moment.
I think they used that same MacGuffin in like every third episode of Walking Dead.
I haven't watched that since the beginning of season 3.
Oh, it's pretty rough right now.
All right, so all the creatures, the mist is forming. They come down, and it turns out the glowworm's just a bunch of dudes on horses with fire.
With fire.
And they they have an awesome attack on this fort. I mean, it's all like, but you know what though? The main thing about watching this again, some of these Vikings that are supposed to be the 13 warriors didn't do too well in this.
No, I think you would have been okay having the three warriors. You know what I mean? Guy who sees, guy who fights duels, and big king. Like just those three guys, I think would have been a little more mobile. Maybe didn't need such a big boat.
Yeah,
that's really the warriors you need.
Just a canoe.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's the archer Viking guy that just gets wiped out. He's a very slow archer. And then there's another guy that tries to get a random fire thing out and gets speared 40 times. That big dude did take about 8 different spears. That was cool.
He was a damaged sponge. Absolutely.
Yeah, but he was doing good. He was doing the best he could. So I would have taken him too. I'd have done the warriors 4.
Yeah. Yeah, but they can't all be heroes.
But I was just a little surprised by that. And also, you know what's interesting? That guy during the documentary, Vlad, said he wishes on the boat they just would have given each person 20 seconds. Oh, hey, I'm a carpenter. Or, hey, I'm a shipbuilder. Or, I'm the rakish one.
You know what movie did that well? Was the Clive Owen King Arthur movie.
Oh, yeah, you know all those characters. Like Ray Winstone, Ray Stevenson, Ian Grufford, Joel Edgerton, Mads Mikkelsen, Hugh Dancy. They're both from Hannibal. Clive Owen.
There you go.
I'm naming most of these dudes.
Yeah, but they establish here's Lancelot and here's what are the other knights there? But they gave every one of them
Hank
a moment.
Hank and Steve and Joe.
Galahad.
Yeah, Galahad. One? Yep, and yeah. Versilitude. No, but yeah. So I mean, a lot of them were underwritten, but I never thought about that until actually watching it today. And maybe I thought about it because I watched that interview with Vlad, where he wishes they would have had more. And I think that was a problem with The Hobbit as well. Some of the dwarves don't really register as much. 13 assassins, though, and 7 samurai and Magnificent Seven, the original. The remake of Seven, they do a great job establishing characters for sure. Yeah. Like
my favorite thing about the Magnificent Seven is that if you watch it, every time Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen are in a scene together, and Yul Brynner has a line, Steve McQueen does something. He'll take off his hat. He'll kick the dirt. He'll twirl his gun, and it was to get the attention off of Yul Brynner.
I was going to say that same thing. It's amazing. And Yul Brynner got so pissed because he was
they
always
kill him.
Yeah, they always did something in the back. He was always flipping a gun. Have you watched 13 Assassins?
Yeah.
Oh, do you love that movie?
So much.
Shinzaemon.
Oh.
I know all those dudes in that movie. Oh, what a great villain, too. All right, well.
No,
but,
right, it was great.
So the battle happens. Why do they leave? Why do the Wendels leave? Because they got him on the, like, they got the humans dead.
Here's what I think. It's one thing for them to kill the room and leave the mystery or just like, but for those Vikings to go back and wake up the next day defeated and have to tell that story, I think it's psychological warfare.
You think that these Neanderthal descendants are using psychological warfare?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. I think they know that, you know, the story is more important. The story of them is more damaging than actually them.
Like fear. Just having someone share that story.
Yep.
My mind is blown.
That's what I firmly believe that.
Oh man. How about this? Let's take a break. I need to recollect because that's a great point. And when we come back, we'll talk more 13th Warrior.
Beautiful.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I love this movie. We took a break, and I just started talking about how much I love this movie. So we took a break to talk about this movie.
Here's what I want to say. On a scale, let's do this. Jurassic Park, Congo, 13th Warrior. What's your favorite Michael Crichton movie?
Oh, I mean Jurassic Park. But the thing is, it had the luxury of being directed by Spielberg.
Right. Imagine a Spielberg 13th Warrior.
Oh, man. Oh, well, oh, goodness. That would be so amazing. Just... But I like McTiernan's, though.
No, and the thing is, I hope they never remake this movie.
No, I hope not either.
Because it's one of those things that's just perfect the way it is.
And I guess, you know what I kind of like about it? It does have these kind of weird ticks to it, but I like that when sometimes there's... The worst movies to me are the bland ones. So Green... Sorry to do this to you, because I know you love Green Lantern. But Green Lantern.
I love the character, not that movie.
That movie, I sat through that movie, right? And I know this isn't really possible, but I didn't laugh. I didn't smile. I didn't smirk. I didn't sneer. I didn't dislike it. I didn't like it. I just sat through it with zero emotions. Does that
make
sense?
You wanna know why? No, it does, because nobody from the director to the actors to anybody in that movie ever took a risk.
Yeah, it's just the most bland. And Martin Campbell did it. This dude's rebooted Bond twice. He did GoldenEye, right, and he did Casino Royale, and he did Zorro. Oh, random fact. The director of Zorro, he was working with Antonio Banderas again, Martin Campbell. They were doing the second Zorro movie. And Martin Campbell walked up to Antonio Banderas. He's like, dude, 13th Warrior, it's a thing online now. And Banderas is like, what? He's like, trust me. He's like, people are going to love this film in the future. And then Banderas is like, yeah, man, this has become a beloved film online.
So oh, because it is so good.
Martin Campbell called it.
Yep.
But he did do Green Lantern. But this movie has its quirks, and I love that about it. Is that, like that? No, I like the personality to it.
Yeah. And but again, these people that made this movie, from every actor to the director, they made a choice, and they committed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what good storytelling and good acting is. It's just making a choice and committing.
They went to the middle of nowhere, British Columbia, and just built forts and acted like Vikings for 6 months. It's amazing.
Right? Well, it's like if you look at Billy Bob Thornton in Sling Blade, right? That's not a safe choice to make.
He made a decision.
He made a decision and he stuck to it. And it's, I think, his best role.
You know what's interesting? I just watched Steven Soderbergh's Unsane recently, and he chose to shoot that on an iPhone. And that's a bold choice. That's mm-hmm. I can do this choice. And in the beginning, it's a little jarring. It kind of looks muddy. It looks like
an iPhone.
Yeah. But you get into it. And then once you're absorbed into it, you don't even notice it anymore, because that's the world. So I love when they make bold choices and just do it, like 148%. I know that's not a
absolutely
percent, but yeah. So do you want to get into the cave sequence in this movie?
Yes. So this is the scene that bothers me the most, and it's because I'm claustrophobic and this is done so well.
Oh, so do you not like The Descent?
I don't like The Descent.
That's my favorite horror movie of the 21st century. But yeah, so I actually wrote that down. What did I write? The cave system looks really real. I'm like, they really built a heck of a set in this place.
And genuinely looked like it would be difficult to film in there.
They did a lot of handheld work. Like they just got mm-hmm. right in the action. I have a question though. So they get to the bottom, they kind of wipe out these guys. They have very lax security, but I don't think they think anyone's going to attack them, so they would have lax security.
Right.
I would suppose. But at the end, so when they get down to the bottom, they find the queen, and Bullvife squares off against the queen. There's a scene where she dunks her big, sharp fingernail into some poison, but she has a massive bowl of it. Why does she just have a thing of poison that can murder people right in front of her? And who brings this to her?
So we never really got to explore too much about who the mother was. But we do know that there's two different interpretations of the mother between Crichton and McTiernan, right?
Yeah.
And so in this world where myth exists and doesn't exist, so like it wasn't a glowworm, but the bone lady at the beginning predictions were right. You come down to say, was that witch lady, was the mother actually a human, or was she something different, or what was going on there? So I think that whether she was actually something more than a human or not, I think she believed she thought she was more.
Oh, for sure.
And so for a person in that mental state, having a bowl of poison is not an awkward thing at all.
Ah, I hate it. That's like saying it's a knight's tale and not a knight's story. Can you just explain it? I was going to have some fun with it. I'm like, what is she doing with all this poison?
Sorry, I got real on you there.
Yeah, I mean, you sold it right there. I could see it. She's just kind of make it. Does she make it? Where does she get this point? Snakes?
I want to say she excretes it.
From the snakes?
From somewhere.
From something? But I just...
I think it's a cocktail of spider snake and poison pufferfish.
Oh, my God. So her people are going out and getting... I guess they did live by the Thundercliffs.
They did.
But I do like that... I remember when I was sitting in the theater, 17 years old, and when I saw Bullvife get slashed by her and then he decapitates her, I was like, no, he's dead. I was so depressed about that. I was not happy that Bullvife was going to eat it.
Right.
And then I do like what's up?
I was thinking the Hollywood story would be that because of his learned upbringing that Ebed was going to save him.
Yeah.
But no, he just dies.
Everyone's like, yeah, he's just dying. Yeah, it's going to happen. But it does lead to one of my favorite moments. And a lot of people hate the final battle scene because it's too abrupt. So I was reading on Reddit and a bunch of comment boards that I could find. And people were complaining that it's too abrupt. But I thought it was just about right. I think the audience would have been too exhausted for another big brawl. And I like that they just focused on Bullvife, this dying dude, taking a massive sword and killing the leader of the Wendels.
No, and I think it needed to be abrupt because I feel that's how Bullvife would have handled it. There would be no toying. I have one job, to kill you as quickly as I can.
Yeah.
And I think those Vikings genuinely love battle. And we saw that with the duel with the shields earlier, mm-hmm. where he decapitated that guy and toyed with him. But I think when you know your time is limited and your strength is wavering, you want to make every motion count. And I think that's why it was such an abrupt change in fighting style.
And I do like that the Wendell leader did charge headlong into battle. He was no punk.
Yeah. No, he was in. He was as committed. He believed in his task.
Yeah, he was not in the back line. So I definitely – it was two really great – I mean, if you think about him and the queen, they were pretty good leaders to keep all these people fed and organized and trained and in shape and not murdering each other. Like, they were good – I mean, he probably killed a lot of people. But, you know.
And that was – that also goes back to my favorite scene in John Carter. Remember when he kills those two white apes? And he challenges the king of the Tharks to be the king. And then they jump at each other. And then when they land, the king of the Tharks just has no head. Like, it was just so – like, I was like, we don't want to waste time here. And I think both sides thought that. You know, we need to get this done.
Yeah, so they just – and then a really cool day battle scene. And also it leads to the speech they make. You know, a cool Viking speech. And then the battle happens, and then Bullvife wins. I love it. And then Bullvife sitting in his chair. I use that like picture all the time for various posts. Just him, like, just a great leader. And then
that picture of him sitting in the chair, he looks just like Viggo from Ghostbusters 2.
I thought he was the same guy from Die Hard 2. The blonde from Die Hard. I'm sorry, the blonde from Die Hard.
Yeah. The guy with the where he's hanging on the chain. He chokes him with the chain.
Yeah.
At the end.
I thought that was him.
Maybe.
For years. But he said I had an interview with McTiernan, and McTiernan never interviews people. So it seemed like
he would have known him.
Yeah. So I was pretty shocked when I heard that. Because for years I've been saying that. IMDb has been here the whole time. I just don't check it. But yeah, so then Banderas takes off, leaves, tells a great story. The movie's over. I love it.
and it's like when your child does something really good, but there's a few little mistakes, you look over them because you love it so much.
That's right.
And so the quirks in this movie, I don't even register them as quirks. I just say that's part of the pack. It's part of the deal.
And I do think I probably defend it more than necessary because of just the dislike that people give it.
But I think the dislike also comes from the time when it came. So it was 1999. So like The Matrix had just come out.
Oh yeah. Phantom Menace was around. The Mummy. This was like a throwback, R-rated.
This is the time of the very beginning of the CG-dominated action film. And this was a jarringly, sometimes disturbing movie to watch because it was so in-your-face and real. It wasn't shiny. And this is the era of the shiny action movie.
And there's a bunch of good creature features in 99. So, like, Deep Blue Sea. Well, I love Deep Blue Sea. Some people say it's not good, but I do.
No, Deep Blue Sea is, like... I have on my computer at all times four movies, just in case.
Really?
They are Deep Blue Sea, The Beastmaster, Coal Miner's Daughter.
Oh, wow.
And The Room. Yeah.
The Room?
The Room, because every now and then you run into somebody who doesn't know what The Room is, and you just throw The Room on, and you're good to go for hours.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
You know what? I don't know why, but I have this movie in every conceivable way you can own it. I remember I was in Korea, and it's like, out there you can just download whatever you want, but I bought it on iTunes. I don't even know. I didn't even watch movies on iTunes, but I was like, I'm going to buy 13th Warrior on iTunes. And I think I bought it again on Vudu. I have every disc that you could possibly – I don't know why, but I just buy everything. This is like my Evil Dead where, people buy every copy of Evil Dead imaginable.
Yeah.
For me, I get every 13th Warrior.
For me, it's Planet of the Apes. I have every conceivable edition of Planet of the Apes.
Nice. And Deep Blue Sea, too. I have the original. The Deep Blue Sea is the first DVD I ever bought.
Well, that's a good first DVD.
Yeah.
See, when I first got my DVD player, DVDs were few and far between, so you kind of had to buy what you could. So my first two, I got my DVD player for my birthday, and then I went and bought DVDs. And so my first two were the first Fast and the Furious movie.
Oh.
And Dude, Where's My Car?
I mean, two car-themed movies. You had something going on there.
No, it was definitely the party pack for the night.
I paid $238 for a DVD player that was massive in my junior year in high school.
Huge.
Yeah, and I used my Burger King money for it.
See, I feel like we would have got along in high school.
All right, so
because I was the guy in high school that was like the champion of the laser disc.
Oh man, that'd have been fun. I never could afford the laser discs.
Here's the real secret is I got a Laserdisc player and five Laserdisc from a yard sale.
What?
In 98. Or no, sorry, like maybe it's 97. So it was before DVDs were like even out yet. And so I was like, this is the future of, it blew my mind. I had only heard about them. And then I got one. I think I paid $50 for the whole thing. And it was like Blade Runner.
Whoa.
And yeah, no, it was good stuff. It was Blade Runner, Alien. What were the other? There was that was like a Hitchcock movie.
Whoever bought these were awesome. Whoever sold this Laserdisc is a cool person.
It is a cool person. So shout out to that guy, wherever he is. But I was like, you guys, your VHS, it's Laserdisc is the future. So I like rebelled against DVDs for a little while. And I finally got on board with Fast and Furious and Dude, Where's My Car?
Do you own Roadhouse on Laserdisc?
No, but I do own it on DVD twice.
Yep, me too. I have the VHS, the DVD, and the Blu-ray.
Well, I had the DVD, then I had to get the DVD that had the Kevin Smith commentary.
Yes, that's why I bought it. I bought it for the Kevin Smith commentary.
That's awesome. All he does is make Chuck Norris jokes.
All right, so here's the deal. We knocked out 13th Warrior. Now we have something special for you all. We were going to open with this, but we wanted to get done with 13th Warrior. What we did was Adam and I are going to figure out, we're going to put together our own 14 warriors. We're each going to have seven each. So, but we picked nine each in case there's overlap, correct? So I'm going to, I guess we'll just announce our seven. And if there's doubles, we'll drop the last two.
And the rules that we gave ourselves was that it needed to be, a human that could exist in our reality.
Yeah. No Legolas.
So it can be from like a future or a past walker. Like nothing, no one with powers, no Deadpool, but a human that could be in. If I need to put together, Mark and I were like, let's take 14 people and go mess up some people in bear costumes. These would be feasible in our reality.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. There would be like we could find them in our world, not space. Exactly, right. Like you
and,
said.
And again, there's a little bit of there's always a little bit of wiggle room, but no powers that would give them an unfair advantage in a fight.
No, I cheated and I added one person from a TV show.
Okay, and that's cool too. I didn't go down that road, but
I had to do it, and you'll understand.
No, and you know what? I think I love you more for it. So do you want to go one each back and forth?
Yeah, go for it. You go first.
Okay, so my first pick, my first draft pick was Nick Parker from the movie Blind Fury, played by Rutger Hauer.
Nick Parker, Blind Fury.
Have you seen Blind Fury?
I have not. What's he all about?
So Nick Parker was a Vietnam POW that got shrapnel in his eyes and went blind, but was trained how to stick fight and sword fight by a general in a POW camp. So then the story picks up with Brendan Cole from Step by Step. He is angry at his mom because his mom is getting a divorce from his dad died. His dad was Rutger Hauer's buddy in Vietnam. And so Rutger Hauer goes to pick this kid up and take him to his mom's house. But then there's like mobsters that want to steal him. So then blind Rutger Hauer reveals that his walking cane is actually a hidden sword and takes on, he's blind and he takes on a whole like squad of mobsters trying to kidnap Brendan Cole.
Whoa.
Yeah, no, it is a dynamite movie.
All right, so we got Rutger Hauer running amok. So my first pick is Artemisia from 300 Rise of an Empire, played by Eva Green.
Okay.
Because she
very good.
She just chews the scenery and just enjoys every second that she's on screen and just owns it. And she's also, like, decapitates a dude and then kisses him. She's, like, just ruthless. If she's on your squad, you probably are going to be afraid of her. But in combat, like, she led her army of people called Immortals. She led an army of people, an elite, like, she runs in front of them. Like, that's, she controls an army of, you know, quote-unquote, Immortals.
And she leads a hand-to-hand combat battle over several boats.
Yes, and she, I don't know, she just, I just love how in that movie, that Eva Green has zero inhibitions. She just has, she just owns it, and she just chews the scenery. And everybody around her, I like Sullivan Stapleton, I thought he was good in the movie, but everybody around her just becomes background fodder because she's so good in it.
Oh no, it's her stage in that movie, 100%.
Yeah, so I got Artemisia. Who's your second pick?
Okay, so my second pick, and I will be okay if you contest this one, but I picked John Rambo from Rambo 4, wielding just his homemade sword knife.
that's the one in the 2000s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm with it.
Because he forges it himself, and I think every good sword movie has a forging scene, and it's bigger than an average knife should be, and he does cut a guy in half with it.
Yeah. All right, I'm
and
I'm
I just
down.
Think a John Rambo on my team is always a good idea.
I love it. So he's just, so no weapons. Oh, he could have a bow and arrow too.
He could, but I think he's at his best when he just has his knife sword.
So I could imagine him running next to Artemisia.
No, I'm already in my head, and Rutger Hauer is like, in the Blind Fury movie, you gotta watch it, Mark. But he always plays like the bumbling Mr. Magoo blind man until he pulls the sword out. So I'm picturing these two like charging the battle, and he's like bumbling beside them, kind of like playing up to playing up the comedy.
And he just surprises about 18 bear people, and they're like, oh my gosh! All right, so my second pick is this one might is from a TV show, but it's Lagertha from Vikings, played by Catherine Winnick, and I've always thought she was like my favorite part of the show. But I love in the latest season, there's a massive battle, and she is killing people with a sword in one hand and a decapitated head in the other. She's stabbing people, and then she's hitting them with a head.
I love when people hit each other with body parts.
I mean, actually, there's like between Artemisia and Lagertha, there's a bunch of decapitations going on here. But I just think she's cool. I think she would add something different to it. I like her as a character, and I just want to see Lagertha in like a big movie that has a $100 million budget hitting people with decapitate. If she took the bear head, she could do some damage with that.
Yeah, I like that we're going down two separate paths here. I was scared we were going to be thinking the same kind of logic, but I don't think we're going to have to get to our two extras. I think we're well apart here. My third pick is Cleric John Preston from Equilibrium.
Oh.
And that was my deep cut Sean Bean movie.
Oh, wow. So Christian Bale?
Christian Bale. He, like, those sword fights in that movie were next, like, just second to none.
You know what I love about that movie is no one in that film can challenge him. There's that scene where Taye Diggs is like, I got, you know, we're going to battle till the death. And then he just wipes him out. No, like nothing.
The closest he comes to getting defeat is a small amount of blood on his collar at the end.
Yeah. He just wipes every, like, there's, I love it. There, oh man, he would kill a lot of bear people.
He would. So that's my third pick was Cleric John Preston.
If y'all haven't watched Equilibrium, you should definitely do it because Sean Bean's in it. And Christian Bale just wipes people out.
And they drive around in Dodge Shadows.
Really?
That's the police cars, like 93 Dodge Shadows.
My first car was a 94 Shadow.
There you go. You could be a policeman in Equilibrium.
Oh, my goodness. All right, so my next pick is Shinzaemon from 13 Assassins.
Nice. I knew that. You talked about that earlier. I'm like, oh, that's one of his picks.
Because I think he would be the leader. And he brought together these really random 13 guys, totally different. They all trusted him blindly. They didn't question anything he did. He led every single battle. He was there at the end. He was just the best dude. Everybody here, like everybody, would just be like, "All right, Shinzaemon's a leader." They wouldn't even have to have a vote. Like, do we need a vote? No. So I think he's the Bullvife of the group.
I was gonna say because Bullvife is very much that. Like, no one, you don't discuss that because it's just a known fact.
Yeah. So if you all haven't seen 13 Assassins, it's by Takashi Miike, and there's tons of blood and gore and violence. And also then watch Blade of the Immortal. There's more blood and violence in that as well. So watch those two and a lot of limbs get hacked. All right, who's your next pick?
My next pick is Robert Roy McGregor from Rob Roy, played by Liam Neeson. Just because he grabs Tim Roth's sword at the end and cleaves the man in half.
Yes, I was about to say that. I was like, let me guess. I think that's one of the more iconic sword fights of all time. And that's not hyperbole.
No. And it's because Tim Roth was a better swordsman, but Rob Roy was a better man.
And he catches a sword.
Yeah. And he calls him in the beginning. He says, I'll take the claymore. And then Tim Roth is like, oh, you're using your big... And he's all tired. And he just plays him like a fool and cuts him right in half.
And he catches a sword.
Yeah. And I think that's the most rewarding kill that I've seen in a movie in a long time, because Tim Roth is scum in that movie.
Yeah, he's super trash.
And just seeing him cleaved in half is beyond rewarding.
Well, have you noticed the pattern here? We have when Christian Bale kills Taye Diggs is such a turd. And then Rob Roy, when he kills Tim Roth, he's such a turd. And then you have Shinzei
Man.
When
John Rambo kills all of Burma.
They're a bunch of turds. All right. Yep. This next pick, you may think it's a joke. It's kind of jokey, okay, but it's also very serious. And it's Farmer from In the Name of the King, Jason Statham.
There's no joking there. There is no joking there.
Because the movie's horrible, and it features the worst sword fight of all time between Michael Madsen and Meatloaf. Like, they're both sweating after one sword swing. But in this movie, Statham destroys, I think, 57 people. Just running around, jumping on heads, slashing people. When his sword fight goes, he just runs. And he's fluid.
And let's not forget that the sequel of that stars our man Dolph.
Yeah, and wearing a tiny scarf and just insulting people.
The whole time.
Yeah, he wears a little scarf. Yeah, and he insults people the entire movie. I almost added him, but I'm like, nah, I like scarves, but that was an unnecessary scarf.
Okay, so my next one you might also think is a joke, but it's not. Dar from The Beastmaster, played by Mark Singer.
I love it.
I love me some Beastmaster. And he's with that sword, so good.
He would just crush everybody?
Yeah, I'm gonna say the movie I watched the most in my childhood was The Beastmaster, and it's all I wanted to be I think Dar the Beastmaster just holds a special place in my heart. So even if he's not the greatest swordsman, he has a part in my team.
I love it. Dar will crush it. My next one is, this is kind of meta, but I'm doing Antonio Banderas from Zorro. So Zorro from Zorro.
So I struggled with that. I had it written down a long time. And then I was like, it was too meta for me. But then I thought, in this, what we're talking about, I think that his style of sword fighting wouldn't be compatible with what we're going into.
I think he would adapt.
And you know what? You're not wrong. He would definitely adapt. And again, it was on my list and off my list about four times.
I just want to have him in here. I love the character Zorro. I like Antonio Banderas. I want him to have more movies. I need to watch the first Zorro again, because remember that sword fight at the end between him and the blondie dude?
Yeah.
That was a great sword fight.
It was fantastic.
And then
those two movies you watch quite a bit, with our kids, and they don't get unentertaining.
Never. All right. Nope. Who you got next?
Okay, here we go. This is because I want my team to be as entertaining as possible. I have Matthias from The Scorpion King, played by The Rock.
He never misses.
He never, like, he has a 100% sword accuracy rating.
And his arrows, too. He's too fast for a guy who can't get hit by arrows.
No, well, he can like, build a house using arrows. He just, instead of nails, he just...
I love him. You know, so I wrote an article... And we'll cover it later in a future podcast, but I wrote an article about all of the property damage in his films for Rotten Tomatoes, and I watched Scorpion King again, and I miss the rundown Scorpion King Dwayne Johnson.
Right. Well, I think that's because he wasn't Dwayne Johnson, then he was The Rock.
Yeah.
And he was definitely being The Rock in those movies.
And he was, I don't know, in a rundown, he almost lost some fights, and now rubber bullets don't hurt him. So I like him a lot in Scorpion King.
Yeah, no, Again, I think Scorpion King is a tarnished property because of like the sequels and just how lame it got with Randy Couture and stuff. But that first one is very much enjoyable.
You know, so I wrote this and then someone copied me. I swear, I wrote one time on Reddit, and then someone used it for Wikipedia, and then someone shared that Wikipedia, and then it blew up. I'm not bitter. So I wrote that. So right now, so you have The Mummy, then you have The Mummy 2, then you have Scorpion King, right? And then they made a prequel to The Scorpion King. Then they made a prequel to that Scorpion King. And then they made a prequel to that Scorpion King.
Right.
So there's a, it's a prequel to a prequel to a prequel to a prequel.
Right. And so I firmly believe this, that any movie containing in the Scorpion King canon, which includes Mummy 2 and then all the Scorpion movies, every movie is in the same universe as the one that follows directly after it, but no other.
Got it.
So the canon changes with every new movie.
Okay. All right, so you got I'm up next. All right, yep. This is one of my favorite characters. I got Okoye from Black Panther.
Okay, very good.
I just love her.
She's awesome. She's dynamite.
And willing to go anywhere, crushes people in the final battle. Cool. Yep. This, like, down to travel to Seoul on a minute's notice. And just, she already showed what she can do in Infinity War. Just standing right in the battle, wiping people out. Oh, I would just love to have her on there. Because she's just, like, she's very professional. If you have her on our team, okay, you're paying, let's say they become all mercenaries, right? And all these people just become mercenaries. And you hire her, she's going to do her job.
Oh, 100%. There's no question with her agenda.
Yeah, she is with you. All right, cool. We got one each?
Yep, one each. So my final pick is Miho from Sin City.
Ooh.
Just like this badass ninja chick.
Yeah, and she's just
like, she's throwing like swastikas ninja stars at people, and she's throwing like just chunks of metal in people's guns so they don't work. And yeah, no, she's just ruthless. Ruthless.
She wiped out a lot of people, didn't she?
Yeah, I think she has the highest kill count in the movie, maybe next to Marv, but I think she's up there.
So get this. It came down to four people who gets into the seven. So I love Mio. But it came down to Mad Mardigan from Willow.
Oh, I very much had Mad Mardigan on my reserve list.
Because he would just be fun. He would add some humor to it. He would be exactly. Because we don't, if you look at our list, who would be I guess Nick Parker with his running.
Nick Parker, yep.
There's really no comedic relief in here.
No.
Zorro could be cheeky.
Could be.
And Mad Mardigan.
Mad Mardigan. No, absolutely. So Mad Mardigan was one of my backup reserves, and the other one was Kai from 47 Ronin.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he would be unintentionally funny because he's just Keanu Reeves.
Yeah. You don't know who mine were? Azeem from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Morgan Freeman.
Nice.
Because he has that awesome sword. And then I had, this one's really jokey, but I had Bemin from Season of the Witch, Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
But he's just too dour. Right? He's too dour in it, though. It was funny, but I thought, if I have to spend another movie with this character, I don't want it.
No, it's too much. It's too much. No, it'd be cool if at the end of our movie, he steps in to make like the final rescue or something. So he's in there for like 3 minutes.
He just comes in. This ride.
Right. He's like Jet Li from Incredibles 2. He's just there for a minute.
And Chuck Norris too, right?
Yeah.
Oh, so I love our team, man.
No, and you know what? No overlap. That was brilliant. I think these 14 warriors could take on any villain team I can think of.
Like with the Miho, and then we have a very eclectic killers group here.
And I want to say we have different sword fighting styles in here as well.
Oh, completely. Do we have anybody who's the same? So Rambo has a big knife, right? Nick Parker has his sword?
Yeah, and so Nick Parker is I would say ninja inspired. It's a shorter blade and it's straight.
Artemisia.
And it's very much. Yeah, go for it. And then.
Oh, sorry. Artemisia, she carries two swords.
Yep, but it's that Roman gladiator fighting style.
Roman. Rambo just has he's just like a linebacker.
He's just a cleaver.
Yeah,
and then we have.
Lagertha. She just has a nice Viking sword, close combat.
Yep.
Hits people with decapitated heads.
Then John Preston from Equilibrium has his like. What did they had the gun kata was their gun style, but they had like a sword fighting style of their own as well.
And then Shinzeman's just a traditional kind of samurai-esque.
Right. And then we have Rob Roy, who I think has two. I think he's got like the Scottish traditional fighting style and also the do what it takes to cut people in half fighting style.
And Statham's just like the great white shark. He's just always moving. Nothing pretty, but he's not going to stop.
Right, and the Beastmaster Dar, he is like every 90s video game. He's a side-scrolling slasher.
And then we kind of have a fencer in Zorro.
Oh, yeah, he's doing the parries and the thrusts. And then with Matthias, it's kind of this hybrid Middle Eastern Egyptian kind of martial arts slash you know, brute strength thing going on.
It's WWE, but he's very fluid for a big man. He's not, there's nothing clunky.
He's like water, man. He just flows.
And Okoye has her staff, so that's a different weapon, and they're all together, just crushing folks with.
Right. Then we have Miho, who just, her body is the weapon, her sword is the accessory.
Ooh, and then Mad Mardigan's just a maniac, swinging at anything. Nothing's right. Pretty about Mad Mardigan.
Cracking jokes. I think Mad Mardigan might not even need to take his sword out because the rest of the team's doing it, and he's just like cracking wise and stealing stuff off people.
You know, in Big Trouble in Little China, when Kurt Russell throws his knife, he accidentally throws his knife to the side, and then Wang just beats up everybody. Then he jumps back into the battle, and everyone's already knocked out. That'll be Mad Mardigan. Yes,
exactly. Those are the Val Kilmer moments.
Hey, well, this was a lot of fun. Do you want to tell people what we're going to be doing probably next month?
So next month, we're going to be doing one of my closet favorites. It's a movie called Steel Dawn. And it's essentially the Patrick Swayze version of Mad Max. In those years when Mad Max, when everybody was making these post-apocalyptic films, Patrick Swayze made one called Steel Dawn. And I didn't put him on my sword fighters list because I want you to see the movie first before we talk about it.
I'm excited. So we'll probably record that end of October, beginning of November. So be on the lookout for that movie. And I just want to say thank you for listening. Thank you for the questions. Also, if you have a chance, go to Movies, Films, and Flicks on iTunes. Rate, review, subscribe. We are now on TuneIn, which is Amazon's podcast system. So if you have an Alexa, is that what they call them? An Alexa for
yes,
Amazon?
I believe so.
We can stream right through that, and you could do it on others, but we are in TuneIn, which is Amazon's, and I'm working on getting into Spotify. So our podcast is going to be everywhere. So right
it's
now,
blowing up.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to be everywhere. But tune in if you just want to kind of listen to it on your Alexa. We're also on we're on a ton of stuff. But
I think our goal, Mark, needs to be to get this podcast on 13 different platforms.
Well, you know what? All right, so I'll count it up, and the next time we get on, I'll say how many we're on. And
very good.
And we're currently still number one ranked on Ranker's best movie podcast list. So
which is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, and the votes keep going up. And what's wild about the other podcasts, some of them have, you know, maybe more votes than us, but they have a lot more downvotes. So that means the people, we don't have many haters on our podcast. But
we're the pure blood vampire of the movie podcast.
We're not the Stephen Dorff of no. Blade. We're the...
I really wanted to put Blade on my team, but he's a vampire. He's a daywalker, so I couldn't. But
yeah,
those Blade movies are so rewarding to watch.
I wanted Elektra from the Daredevil TV show, but she kind of has some powers. And I wanted Daniel Wu from Into the Badlands, but he kind of has some powers. So I left those out. I decided to kind of not pick those. But so 13. So I'll count them up. And the next time we pod, I'll let you know how many there are. And so the plan is to get to 13 different places you can listen to our podcast. So, hey, so for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Adam Hodgins, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week.